I want to thank Dr. Herman, and please God, we'll have him back again for Torah Motion. If he agrees and you agree, right, then we'll all agree. And I want to thank him for his series on the Gaonim, as we said at the beginning, not a well-known subject, really. I think many people sort of a missing era of Jewish history, and it's really, there's much more to say. 4 hours is great, but it just scratches the surface. So, okay, Dr. Herman, we'll let you, Achron Chaviv, the last class for this particular series, and then we'll move forward. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman.
Okay.
All right, so I'm going to share my screen again. I'm going to ask somebody who's done.
Sorry, you just need to unmute yourself, Dr. Herman.
Yeah, okay. Is my screen share working here? Excellent. Okay, great. All right, so as Rabbi Kalman said, this is the last of our four classes on the Gaonim. Hopefully they have been, they've served their purpose, which was twofold, to introduce everyone to the world of the Gaonim, to sort of situate these figures and sort of give a little bit of a map, a mental map perhaps, about who they were, how they developed, why they, when they were, etc. And also just to get a little bit of a sense of their contributions. These were figures who in many ways shaped medieval Judaism. And if you want to really understand someone like the Rif, who we talked about last week a little bit, or the Rambam, you really need to understand the world that they encountered. And that world was very, very much shaped by the Gaonim, especially the later Gaonim, who we focused on, in this series. As I said last week, as we did previously, I prefer everyone to sort of keep, as many people keep their cameras on as possible, just to make this sort of as interactive as possible. And I'll sort of take questions as we go, and feel free, of course, to interrupt. And I will, again, as we've been doing, invite people to participate, to read certain texts in English. Okay, so this is the last of our class. We've spent the first class sort of entering the Gaonic world, as we called it, sort of understanding what the Gaonim did and why they mattered. And then I introduced you to four, this is the fourth one, major late Gaonic figures. And these are basically, certainly in the later period, the Gaonim that we know the most about. That is Saadia Gaon, Shira Gaon, Haya Gaon, and this week Shmuel ben Chofni Gaon. These are the figures we know the most about, the most we can sort of give a biography for, and certainly give an intellectual biography for. These are the figures who gave us the most writings, and we can sort of construct as much as we can of their worlds over other figures. There are some pre-Saadia figures who we know more about. Natron Igon, I think I mentioned, is one of the figures who's most familiar to scholars. But generally speaking, as I said, with Saadia as a real turning point in terms of the intellectual and cultural output of the academies, as well as, I would argue, I would think, and we'll see more about this with Shmuel ben Chofni especially, and as we saw with Shirin Haigon, a greater outward-looking position. That is, with the last of the Gaonic figures, the Gaonim began to look beyond the four walls of the academy and produce writings that were inviting and engaging with Jewish communities that were growing up throughout the Mediterranean, some of which we know, like places like North Africa and Cairo 1, that asked Shrier the questions that prompted the Igeret. Other places we have fewer figures for, but we can assume, and we know that based on sort of geographic toponyms, etc., that the Gaonim communicate with these places. So let's begin with an introduction to Shmuel ben Chofni as a figure. And the truth is, there's a lot that we don't know about Shmuel ben Chofni, about his personal life, and about sort of how he lived on a day-to-day basis. Everything we sort of know can be constructed based on other accounts of the academies, as well as his own writings, which really give us a viewpoint into obviously his intellectual output, less so into his family, in his daily life, etc., as is the case with most medieval figures, save the Rambam. So the first thing to know about Shmuel ben Chofni's family, is that he came from a Gaonic family. This is not at all surprising, right? I think I mentioned this already, that the vast majority of the Gaonim, and here Saadia is the exception that proves the rule, the vast majority of the Gaonim came from families of other Gaonim, right? So the leading families in Baghdad produced most of the leaders of the institutions, they had probably had the most money. They certainly led the yeshivot in Baghdad, as we saw. This, and here you see three figures, in Shmuel's family who were all Gaonim. They have Cohen Tzedek ben Joseph Gaon, a figure we don't know that much about. Nehemiah Gaon, who I'll talk about more in a second, and, who was his son, and Nehemiah's nephew, grandson of Cohen Tzedek, Shmuel ben Chofni, right? Not at all surprising that one family, one patrilineal line produced a number of Gaonim, right? And also not surprising that these were not, the position was not handed down father to son. But as you see here, based on the dates, that the there was a gap usually between when a father and a son, or in this case, an uncle and a nephew, took over to serve as Gaon, right? This is because the Gaonic families, while they were prominent, usually didn't appoint their own sons to take the place of their, take their father's place once the father had died. It's also interesting, in the case of Shmuel ben Chofni, that, these figures, here we'll see them again, in Brody's list of the Gaonim, right? These figures actually, occupied places in two different academies, right? Cohen Tzedek and Nehemiah Gaon were both leaders of Pumpedita, whereas Shmuel ben Chofni was the head of the academy in Sura. Now, why this is, we don't really know. It requires a little bit of speculation, but it probably has to do with at least two major factors, maybe more. The first is an ongoing fight, it seems, between the Shmuel ben Chofni's family, Cohen Tzedek's descendants, and Shrira Gaon's descendants. As you see just on his list, there were, Brody put, disputed after the, in the 943 figure in Pumbedita. Right? Pumbedita was rocked by, dispute, seemingly lasting decades with breakoff figures and people starting their own splinter academies. Not all the details, are well constructed, and we're really often looking through Shira's eyes on these events. So we don't really know, certainly with objective perspective, what happened. As well as the fact that Sura was, as I said before, moribund basically throughout the 10th century, right? The appointment of Sadia, you see this, Brody has this interregnum before 928 when Sadia was appointed in the right-hand column in Sura, right? Which tells us that the academy was not doing great. So Sadia had a very brief successor who here Brody tells us that resigned in 943, after which the academy was closed. So we're talking 40 plus years before there's another leader of Sura. And then again, when Shmuel ben Chofni comes in, you know, almost at the turn of the millennium, right, we're talking about an academy that was not in good shape for decades in the latter part of the 10th century, perhaps the entire 10th century. And maybe these two things can go together. That is, maybe the fights in Pumbedita forced Shmuel ben Chofni to rejuvenate an academy. And this would help explain how he became the leader of Sura, right? It's also possible that, and this is, I think, a little more speculative, but one wonders to the extent to which Shmuel ben Chofni was sort of in Sadia Gaon's image. I'll try and show this in the latter half of today's class, that is, Shmuel ben Chofni was more open-minded, more engaged, more productive theologically, etc., than his competitors in Pumbedita. Sura, maybe certainly in Sadia's times, became this sort of had its image as a different kind of place, perhaps, than the ideology put forward or implicit in their thought of Shura and Hai Gaon. One other thing you need to know about their families before we move on to the next slide is that Shmuel ben Chofni's daughter married Hai Gaon, right? So we're talking, so even though they were sort of contemporaries, Samuel was Hai Gaon's father-in-law. This, we don't really know much about this, but it's, when this is event is reported in Gaonic letters, it's linked with this idea that, you know, peace, shalom was made between the two academies. So it suggests to me and to others that there is something of a political arranged marriage, that sought to sort of tamp down on the bitterness between Shrir Gaon and Hai Gaon and their sort of model or their family and Shmuel ben Chofni's family, in the late latter part of the 10th, beginning in the 11th century. Although, as we'll see in a minute, Shmuel ben Chofni and Hai Gaon didn't always see eye to eye on some pretty, pretty important issues. Okay. So what do we know about Shmuel ben Chofni? So I'll just walk you through some of the earlier medieval sources before we try and get something a little bit bigger. So if you look here, this is a source we've talked about a number of times. This is Ibn Daud's Sefer HaKabbalah, written in late 12th century Spain, a sort of sacred history of rabbinic Judaism up until the Almohad persecutions in Spain, right? And here, Ibn Daud gives a lot of information about the Gaonim, right, which he sort of assembled from other sources and probably added to his own spin sometimes, right? And here we have just a very brief line about Shmuel ben Chafni. Speaking here, we're talking about Hai Gaon. He says, V'yamav, in the days of Hai Gaon, Haya Rosh Yeshiva B'mata Machasya, that is Surah, Chotno Abi Ishto, that is his father-in-law, that is Hai Gaon's father-in-law, was Shmuel ben Shmuel HaKohen ben Chafni, right? That's what we know. Gam Hu, he tells us, Shmuel ben Chafni, Chiber Svarim Harbeh. He wrote lots and lots of books, right? We don't know much about these books. Ibn Daud doesn't think that it's, he needs to give us much detail. Perhaps people had access to them, or maybe he didn't have access to them, but we know he had already had this reputation in the late 12th century of writing many books. And this is repeated in the Meiri's Sefer HaKabbalah, which has a lot of similarities with, not just in title, with Ibn Daud's Sefer HaKabbalah, right? He tells us, Shmuel ben Chafni gam hu chiber svarim harbeh, he wrote lots of books. Right? Here he adds in a little comment that is not found in Ibn Daud. He tells us that the contents of these works are not all that reliable. Right? So we already have it. Now we have two interesting data points that we'll try and fill in a second. One is that we can say that Shmuel ben Chafni was very productive. Right? He wrote lots and lots and lots, and that's something that is very clear. And it seems that he did not have the greatest reputation. That is, on certain matters, and not clear what they are here, whether it's halakhic matters or theological matters or something else, for some reason, he did not have the greatest reputation among later medieval rabbinic authorities, right? And we'll talk about why that is throughout today's class. Okay. One of the reasons that that Shmuel ben Chafni was not accepted, or maybe his ideas were not considered as authoritative, is that he did battle with his son-in-law, Hai Gaon, about theological matters, right? And Hai Gaon, as we talked about last week, was respected as sort of the last and the greatest of the Gaonim, the most important halakhic authority in the Gaonic period, right? And the very fact that we have certain tshuvot where, and we'll read this one in a second, I'll ask someone to read in a second, where Hai Gaon disagrees, rejects his father-in-law's views, right? Would probably have contributed to that idea that Shmuel ben Chafni was not perhaps a theological or otherwise authority that we should rely on, we being, you know, later rabbinic figures. And does someone want to read this tshuva from collection of Tshuvot HaGaonim? And Lick, I know we had some good readers last time. Anyone want to jump in English for us?
Okay, yes. I'll read.
Great.
Okay, so Marav Shmuel Gaon and those like him who read many Gentile books say that these visions are only shown to prophets and that miracles are only performed for prophets.
Okay, so here we have, one second. So here we have something very interesting here, right? The first thing that Hai Gaon tells us is that his father-in-law, he barely wrote the Sifrei Nochrim, right? He read lots of Goyesha writings, let's say. We can translate that into English. He read lots of writings by Gentiles, that is Muslims, right? So now already he's telling us that that his father-in-law, Shmuel ben Chafni, maybe would, because of this, it infected his views, I think is what he's telling us. And therefore, the visions that appear, here we're talking about some of the visions in rabbinic literature. He says, well, no, those were only for prophets, not for other people. Do you want to continue?
Oh, sorry. They deny all events about which it is said that a miracle was done for a righteous person, saying that this is not a reliable halakha tradition. We believe that God does perform miracles for the righteous, even great wonders. It is not beyond him to show them the intimate details of his palaces and the stations of the angels.
Okay, here we have a very interesting comment from a lot, there's lots to unpack here. We'll tell that, and that tells us a lot, I think, about both Hai Gaon and Shmuel ben Chafni. Right. The first is that, Shmuel ben Chafni here denies that events done for righteous individuals, that is non people who are not prophets, people in rabbinic literature and the Midrash, He says those are unreliable traditions. Here, the Hebrew word is halakha. The word halakha obviously does not mean law in this context. In fact, in most Gaonic writings, I mean, when it's used to not mean sort of legal rulings, it very often means a tradition, a reliable tradition, a received tradition, something that we can trust. Right. So here, Shimon Chafni is telling us that those reports in rabbinic literature about these miracles for individuals are not reliable, right? So there's something of a sort of naturalist, a rationalist, let's say, perspective that's implied here. Also, he's telling us that within rabbinic literature, and we saw this last week, we'll see much more of it with Shmuel ben Chafni, that there's such thing as sort of reliable and unreliable reports, right? So we saw last week the Agadah, some Gaonim said, well, those are not reliable. I mean, those are not true traditions. Those are not received traditions. And Shmuel ben Chafni is telling us that these sort of miracles for people who are not prophets are not reliable. Whereas High Gaon said, no, we believe that is the case. We do trust and we take these things perhaps a little more literally, and we understand the stories in rabbinic literature to be more, to be accepted and straightforward, perhaps interpreted in a more literal way. And we'll see that as we go on. Okay, so one other piece of Shmuel ben Chafni's image, and this is tells us more, not because we trust it, but because it sort of speaks to what later people had to do about Shmuel ben Chafni, right? This was a letter that we saw last week from Yitzchak of Akko, right? In the Sefer Me'irat Einayim. And I talked about last week how this story, this in Yitzchak of Akko has reports of the Gaonim sort of pulling back from or counseling against this study of philosophy, right? And I mentioned that a number of scholars think that this letter is a later medieval forgery because it just doesn't seem to jive very well with what we know about the Gaonim. And here, this is another passage in the letter that we didn't talk about last week. We have a source telling us this. This letter tells us that our teacher Shmuel ben Chafni Gaon, because he was, these words are a little hard to translate, a pioneer and a primary cause, right? Kodem and Ikar, I'm not sure of these matters of philosophy, witnessed the damages that come from them and withdrew from their study. So according to Yitzchak of Akko, right, Shmuel ben Chafni studied philosophy and then withdrew and said, no, we shouldn't study philosophy. Right? There's no evidence in Shmuel ben Chafni's writings that this actually happened, right? There's nothing to support this idea. But what it tells us, I think, is that later figures realized how engaged Shmuel ben Chafni was with non-Jewish philosophy, theology. And they saw for them that was dangerous, and they must have said, well, it must be that Shmuel ben Chafni withdrew from these things. Right? We have similar reports, perhaps, we have definitely similar reports, about the Rambam allegedly converting to Kabbalah on his deathbed. Such stories are very common and obviously shouldn't be taken as historical truth, but tell us more about the people who recounted these stories. And in this case, there's obviously no reason to believe that Shmuel ben Chafni withdrew from the study of Gentile theology, only that later figures found this quite problematic. Okay, what about the other aspect of Shmuel ben Chafni, not only his sort of engagement with theology, but also his other, his writing. So here we have a medieval book list from the Cairo Geniza, right? That's organized based on author. Here on the bottom, anyone sort of sees the big line crossing through the manuscript in the middle, on the bottom third, it says, on the right below this, it says Rabbeinu Saadia. So we have a list of Saadia Gaon's writings that were in this either bookseller or personal collection that were included. But here on the top, you see a list of Samuel ben Chafni's writings, right? So this list is organized based on author, and clearly the person who was doing it wasn't sort of writing a list for public consumption, just for personal knowledge, and was writing all sorts of directions and not the neatest or easiest to read handwriting. But this is a very long list of only a partial list of Shmuel ben Chafni's massive corpus, right? Anyone who makes sense knows that even the most basic Arabic, you can see that each of these words, these book titles starts with the letters Aleph Lamed, right? The something, right? The book of this, the book of that, right? So that is very clear in Shmuel ben Chafni's writings. This is only a partial list of his massive corpus. What do we know about his published? So what published works are there? So the first one published, of his, monographs, was this book on Hilchot Brachot, which is almost certainly a translation from the original Judeo-Arabic, right? You can find this on Hebrew Books, under Sha'ari Brachot of Shmuel ben Chafni Gaon. And we also have his commentary on Genesis that is translated, is printed in a facing Arabic and or Judeo-Arabic and Hebrew edition. Other works include a very, very interesting introduction to the Talmud. We'll talk about this in the second half of today's class. We have this book on the laws of maturity. Right? It's a sort of complicated Talmudic process. When do people become mature physically, and how does that impact their obligation to Jewish law? A lot of the stuff that I am, the best book I would say on certainly biography and collection of material on Shmuel ben Chofni is by David Sklar, who wrote this book, Samuel ben Chofni and His Cultural World. David published two books in Arabic that he translated that are published in the back of this volume, which we'll see a little bit later. And also another work that was published not so long ago is by my colleague Zvi Stamfer. This is Shmuel ben Chofni's Sefer HaGirushin. That is his book on the laws of divorce, right?
This is Yehuda Zvi Stamfer.
Yeah. Stamfer is a scholar living in Israel who has, if you want to look him up, you can look him up on academia.edu. He's got some great writings on Shmuel ben Chofni and other important figures. Okay. Other works that have been published, there's one other work, just that I put a picture of here, is Shmuel ben Chofni's writings on the laws of tzitzit. This was included in a volume called Kliel Techelet, right, that brought a number of medieval works on the laws of tzitzit, right? And other works that some of which have been printed and some not, are these letters. These are just two of, a few dozen letters that we know Shmuel ben Chofni wrote that are published in the Cairo Geniza here. These two letters were both sent, 20 plus years apart to the Jewish community in Cairo 1, which we already encountered today and last time, right? That reflect Shmuel ben Chofni's sort of program and public face. So there, I would say that we can say a lot about Shmuel ben Chofni. Each of these works tells us something new about our figure. But just summarizing, here you see, the name Shmuel ben Chofni from a nice Geniza manuscript. A few things. One is that Shmuel ben Chofni was staggeringly productive, right? Sklar, in his work, lists something like 54 or more, almost 60 books or essays, theological, halachic, and other topics that Samuel ben Chofni wrote. This is independent of the number of tshuvot that he wrote, not so many of which survived, letters and other writings. So we know that, when the Rishonim said that Shmuel ben Chofni wrote many books, that is certainly a position that we can uphold and say it's correct, right? It is true that Shmuel ben Chofni, perhaps more than other Gaonim, other than arguably Sadia, was open to, what they call Gentile, what we might sort of more specifically refer to as Muslim wisdom, right? He read a lot in non-Jewish literature, as his son-in-law tells us, and this apparently influenced his ideas, theological and otherwise. And he had a controversial and rather lukewarm reception among later medieval Jews, right? This starting, first and foremost, with his son-in-law, Haigaon, who tells us that, his father-in-law was not maybe correct on a number of theological matters. Okay, so that's sort of an introduction. Hopefully we can sort of get a sense of our figure. He lived in the late 10th, early 11th centuries, was the head of the Academy in Sura from a prominent family who did a lot of wrote a lot of influential and controversial works in Arabic and Hebrew in Baghdad. Okay, so let's, before we get to the next, who the Gaonim were, who Shmuel ben Chofni was, the second half is, what he contributed, we can pause for a couple questions now. Let me pull up I'm just going to open the chat quickly.
There's something that I asked you which didn't print very well.
Please.
Halacha, yes. Esav Shone et Yaakov. Is it possible that the word halacha was used, that that's a Gaonic saying, and it means, as you say, an unreliable tradition, but not as we, the halakha that we're accustomed to.
Yes, the history of the phrase halakha Esav sonet Yaakov is long and convoluted. It's a good question. It's a good example. And I don't know the origin of that phrase in particular. I can't remember off the top of my head all the sort of detailed origin of that phrase. But the word halakha there clearly means tradition. It doesn't mean like a law. It doesn't mean there's some sort of obligation as a law, but it means a tradition. It means a sort of received tradition here. There's a couple other quick questions. One, just quickly here on this on the chat, there's a question about how the Gaonim cited passages from the Talmud. So obviously some of them had manuscripts. Other times it seems like the Gaonic Academies really insisted on oral transmission of the Talmud. We have a number of letters from the Gaonim saying that the students of the yeshivot have never heard of anything of a book, right? It might be an exaggeration, but it certainly tells us that they prized oral transmission, and scholars sort of debate exactly how literally to take those statements. And then there's a question here about Shmuel ben Eli, who was the head of the academy in Baghdad did battle with Maimonides. It's a good question. We have Shmuel ben Eli is a different sort of beast. He wasn't, there's no continual Gaonic tradition. He was more of a reconstituted academy. And Shmuel ben Eli certainly did not have the, as much as he tried to announce that he did, he certainly didn't have the intellectual heft of the earlier Gaonim, and certainly did not have the authority that other Gaonic thinkers had in the, up into the 11th century. But those are very good questions, and feel free to pipe in with more either in person, audio speaking or on the chat. Okay, so let's talk about some of Shmuel ben Chofni's major claims. I want to go through three different topics very briefly, each of which obviously deserves a much greater attention than we can give it in this introductory classes. So the first, I just want to talk about Shmuel ben Eli's theology. We already saw that this was controversial, and a major portion of his writings was dedicated to this topic. Then I want to talk about his introduction to the Talmud. We saw already a little bit how important this work was, but I want to show you what's interesting about it, and this really fascinating book that hopefully will be published not so long from now. Some pieces of it are already published. And finally, I want to show you sort of some of the controversies surrounding Shmuel ben Chofni as they pertain to this very specific story of the revivification of one of the prophets at Ein Dor, which may be familiar to anyone who's learned Sefer Shmuel. Okay, so let's talk first about Shmuel ben Chofni's theological writing. So one of the important and interesting theological works that Shmuel ben Chofni wrote, published by Sklar in his edition that I already showed you, called Shmuel ben Chofni and His Cultural World, is this book called The Ten Questions, right? Written in Arabic. Anyone can see this manuscript. Here's the manuscript from the very first question of the Ten Questions, right? It says Bishmi Chokmana at the very first time, and then the first line, and then on the second line, we already get into the Arabic here, Al-Masala, Al-Aula, the first question is the following. Okay, we'll talk about the contents of the question in a second, right? So what do we know about this work? It was written, obviously, in the late 10th, early 11th century. We really can't date many of Shmuel ben Chofni's works sort of within the corpus. It's very difficult. Might be something we could do a little bit later as scholarship progresses, but not yet. Sklar says this was written in the torturous and convoluted style of Kalam theology, right? This was very much written in the way that people wrote theology, that is, Muslims wrote theology in the late 10th, early 11th centuries, right? Clearly showing Samuel's deep familiarity with this material. And we don't know much about, who posed these questions. It seems that they were actually questions asked of Shmuel ben Chofni, although I guess it's possible that he sort of invented them based on what he thought people would be interested in and used this as a format. It was sent to an unknown rabbinic correspondent. Sklar has some suggestions as to who it might be, but we don't know for sure. And what's another interesting piece of this, and this sort of distinguishes Samuel from Sadia, is that while he is very critical of the Karaites, he is in this work and elsewhere fairly respectful of them, right? He doesn't, he learns from them, or he says nice things, has nice things to say about them. He certainly doesn't have the same kind of rancor that you find in the writings of Sadat Gaon. So what were the 10 questions? We don't actually have all 10 of them. We have a few, but I just want to show you some of the questions and then talk perhaps about what they mean. So the first question is the one you see here in the manuscript, is the following. Does agreement on something as a religious practice constitute an authoritative source for it or not? Okay, so it's a little bit of a strange question, something that we don't really know what it means. But if you understand Samuel's context, it actually becomes very, very clear. This is, namely, that in Islamic law, there's a concept called ijma, which means that agreement either of the nation, but more likely all of sort of the legal experts, right? And even though that practice or that ruling doesn't have a source in, authoritative literature, nevertheless, if there's communal consensus or juristic consensus about a practice, then it nevertheless has to be upheld. So this question that was posed of Samuel, or something that he invented, was asked, is that the case in Jewish law, right? So it already tells us something a little bit about his audience and about his correspondent. Here we have another very interesting question. Does the law of Moses, that is, the Torah, may peace be upon him, obligate others besides Israelites, right? Here we have a question about the universality of the law. Very interesting question, and obviously one that has ongoing, discourse in Jewish history, right? But one that had took on a very specific meaning also in this same interreligious context, right? We have Christianity and certainly Islam sort of claiming to universal authority, and then everyone ideally or should be a Christian and a Muslim, even though the Muslims sort of let minorities live. They thought it was obviously better to be a Muslim than a Jew or a Christian, right? And so the question became sort of, what is the Jewish perspective on the universality of the law? And Samuel's answer, which we don't have time to go into, is certainly not as straightforward as we would think. One of the things that's striking about Samuel's writings on this topic, of which there are several, is that he is certainly doesn't take the same perspective that you see in like 19th, 20th, 21st century Jewish thinkers, right? He's got a much more, optimistic or obligatory perhaps perspective on the idea that non-Jews have certain obligations than we're sort of maybe used to hearing in contemporary Jewish literature. Here we have another very, very straightforward, question number four, a very, very common question that was posed of many theologians in this period, right? Concerning, this is not a question, but a statement, I guess, concerning the imposition of obligation and associated matters. That is, what happens when, how can God impose obligations? What are the rules that pertain to the imposition of obligation? Upon whom can God place commandments, right? Do you have to be a certain age, a certain level of knowledge, a free person, et cetera, all these sort of basic questions. Really, you can see here very fundamental questions that are not treated certainly in earlier Jewish literature in a systematic way, the way that Shmuel ben Chofni did, and he did it in ways that were very similar to his non-Jewish contemporaries. And finally, an issue that we already saw in Sadat Gaon, and certainly was very enduring question, but concerning plain sense and figurative language. So here too, we have, this is obviously a pressing issue, and we saw, 2 weeks ago, Sadia was very concerned with this topic, and Shmuel ben Chofni continues, as he does very often, he continues in sort of Sadia's veins. He doesn't always agree with Sadia, but he is very much on the same page topically as Sadia was. And here we have in the 10 questions, one of the questions is sort of, how do we figure out when we should take texts literally, the plain sense, and when they should be interpreted figuratively. So that sort of gives us a sense, I think, of the big questions that he asks in this book of 10 questions. This is just one of, a dozen, maybe a little bit less, theological writings that Shmuel ben Chofni produced. But this one's actually accessible both in the original Arabic and Sclater published it in English. So anyone who wants to read it can look in his edition, and you can get a sort of sense for a torturous and convoluted style that this book is written in. It's very interesting, but it is certainly slow going, let's say. Okay. So that gives us a sense a little bit of Samuel's theological perspectives. What about this book that I've talked about a number of times, the Introduction to the Talmud, also written in Arabic? And here you see chapter 54 in the manuscripts from the Cairo Geniza. Right, the chapter heading, again, this is in Arabic. You have the Aleph Lamed, the word the, right, at the beginning, and a relatively clear reading. This is not the clearest of manuscripts, but we certainly can make out some of the letters. Isn't that, compared to other manuscripts, not that complicated? Okay, so there's a lot to say about this work. This is, I think, a very, very interesting Gaonic work that in some ways compares, might be compared to similar modern introductions to the Talmud that we see in English, in Hebrew, that are addressing and done for similar reasons. That is, that in the modern times, when someone has to write an introduction to the Talmud, it's usually for people who didn't come up in sort of the yeshiva system, right? I think the same is probably true about Shmuel ben Chafni's own introduction to the Talmud. That is, it isn't written for people who are already bought in or already educated in the system. Maybe it is, and it does provide some sort of big questions for them, but it's also written with beginners and other people in mind, right? And part of this you can see already in his choice of language, right? He didn't write this in Hebrew or in Aramaic. He wrote it in Arabic. So obviously he's writing it's like writing an English introduction to the Talmud. You're writing an Arabic introduction to the Talmud. Same idea. Your audience is clearly not, their first language is not the language of the Talmud, right? And he's clearly speaking to these to a broader audience and reaching out to them. And for this reason, this is an incredibly diverse work. And we're not going to have time to go through all of the different pieces of it, but we'll see in a second, it has a dictionary. It has methodological reflections on tradition that we'll delve into in a second. He has sort of introduction to people, who, what, where, when, why, sort of the people of the Talmud, where they lived, who they studied with, sort of all the basic things you'd get in any introduction to the Talmud that you find in the medieval period or in the modern period, excuse me, is a lot of it is prefigured in Samuel's introduction. For that reason, it can be compared to a lot of these works that we see that we might be familiar with today, right? And that makes it a very, very interesting work because it tells us so much about Samuel's audience, right? These were people who were perhaps not educated in the yeshiva. They were curious intellectually. They had fluency in Arabic. They were comfortable with, Arabic and Islamic ideas that appear in this text, but they wanted, nevertheless, to access the Talmud. And Samuel, realizing that people outside of the academies needed a guidebook, wrote this lengthy work that is made up of well over 150 chapters. This would have been a massive collection. Not all of it, unfortunately, survived, and only a few dozen chapters, maybe less, have been published. But more should be coming out in the next few years. Okay, so let's delve into some of the content of this work. I picked one chapter that is conveniently translated in English, or parts of it, by Brody, and which ties together with some of the issues that we saw already with Santigone and with Shrira and Haigon. That is this concern, this interest with the nature of rabbinic tradition, right? And one of the major concerns about rabbinic tradition that came up in the medieval period and thereafter was what Samuel says in a little bit technical term, and this is the fifth chapter, the discourse concerning the causes as a result of which disagreements arose between the tradents, that is the transmitters of tradition, in the Mishnah and Talmud. And we say that this has 10 causes, right? This is a very long chapter title. I don't think anyone would get away with a chapter title with so many words today. But this was the how people wrote in the medieval period, right? We have this chapter on why the rabbis debate so much. That's his question, the Mishnah and Talmud. And he tells us there are 10 what he calls causes for disagreement. And anyone who remembers from the previous sessions about Sadia and Shurin and Haigaon will recognize this problem, right? We want to know, explain why there's disagreement. And they're sort of hesitant to tell you, well, it's just because they were arguing there's debate. So he comes up with other, what we might call excuses or explanations for disagreement, right? So I want to go through a few of them. I didn't translate them all, but there's a bunch of them that are worth reading. Maybe we'll skip some depending on the time. Okay, so he tells us the first cause for disagreement is that the tradition was transmitted concerning two sets of circumstances. In one case is negatively and another case positively. Right, so we have two traditions. One say X is allowed, the other say it's not allowed, right? you can cook today, you can't cook today. That's the tradition. And there is no contradiction between them. Why? Because they apply to different circumstances. When you're allowed to cook on Yom Tov, on the festivals, when you're not allowed to cook on Shabbat, right? That's an example, right? He's telling us, this is not entirely clear that there's good examples to prove this in rabbinic literature, but that's a pretty standard Gaonic explanation, right? There's not real debate, it's not true debate, but just debates about how to apply the cases. The third cause is that transmitter's tradition gives rise to disagreement with respect to its interpretations, not with regard to the precise formulation. Because of this, they say to each other, did you hear this specifically, or did you derive it from a generalization, as they say in the Talmud, right? The Talmud tells us, Miklala Itmar, is this derived by implication, right? Or did you hear this explicitly, right? And therefore, later interpreters of the traditions, he tells us, could disagree about the interpretation of earlier traditions, not because there was mistakes, but just because things were not formulated precisely, perhaps. And number four, right, the fourth cause is that one of the traditions heard a general tradition and the other heard a specific tradition. This, you know, the confusion between general and specific is something we saw in Sadia and something comes up all over Islamic literature, right? And because they said, Rabbi Yochanan said, one cannot learn from general rules. So he says, why is there debate? Well, because some people tried to derive from general rules and then that ended up contradicting specific traditions. But he's telling, but Samuel Chabad is telling us it's not really a contradiction. Right? He brings this passage from Rabbi Yochanan, which doesn't quite support his argument, but certainly is helpful in the general distinction. These are some of his excuses. Let's go on a couple more. And the fifth cause is that some of the traditions remembered the tradition, some forgot. Rabbi Sasadia already said something very similar, right? People forgot, and that's why it's not because they were really arguing, but their memories weren't so good. It was a broken telephone model of tradition. And finally, the last one we'll see today, is that some of the traditions, that is the rabbis, the transmitters, grasped the tradition, preserved it, and some of them did not grasp it because of their preoccupation, believe something different concerning it than what the transmitter has said. That is, people misunderstood, right? So we have now, half a dozen of the 10 causes that Samuel Ben Chofni identified, all of which sort of say debate did not come about because of earnest intellectual disagreement. Debate did not come about because people, sat down in a text and argued about its meaning. Debate came about because of mistakes or because of misinterpretations, right? People were forgetful. People sort of assumed the wrong thing, but ultimately the tradition is unified and has a clear authority, and it all sort of comes back to received tradition, not to the creativity and the sort of interpretation and generative kind of reasoning that we see that we might assume in rabbinic literature. And in fact, this Samuel Ben Chofni here is so the last of, but are the most detailed of the Gaonim, who really gives us this perspective on Jewish tradition. That is, the Gaonic position is basically that the material in rabbinic literature is passed down from the prophets, right, who obviously received it from God. And debates come about because of mistakes or misunderstandings or something like that, as opposed to the position that's typified by the Rambam, which is that Chazal, or the rabbis, when they were, why do we have debate? Because they were thinking through the law and arguing about it, right? They saw an ambiguous text and they disagreed about its interpretation. That's sort of the Maimonidean position. And the Gaonic position is, no, the debates came about because of mistakes or whatnot, and all because all the material is ultimately not from the rabbis generating law, but the rabbis receiving it from the prophets and who received it from God, right? That's sort of the two models we have in the medieval Islamic world. And Shmuel Ben Chofni is giving voice to that very firmly here. Okay, what else do we know about this introduction to the Talmud? Here we have a page from Abramson's edition of chapter 154. And here, just to give an example, the latter part of this work, is treats not the sort of big questions that we just saw, but he is an organization of a collection of all the traditions associated with figures X, Y, and Z, right? So he names, whatever it is, a dozen, maybe more, rabbinic figures who appear in the Mishnah and Talmud, and tells us, here's all the traditions that this person collected, right? And here we have chapter 154 is about Nachum Hamadi, right? Not a very popular figure in rabbinic literature, not someone where, comes up all the time, but it just shows you sort of the thoroughness that Shmuel Ben Chofni presented when putting his work. And what seems like, you know, obviously this is somebody who had a complete mastery of the Talmudic corpus, such that he could do such a thing. That is, such that he could say, oh, like, what are the, you know, I don't know, I don't know what number he comes here, but, you know, 10 or 5, what times the Nachum Amadi comes up in all of Shas. And he just rattles them off like that. Right? He didn't have a computer. He didn't have everything, you know, to look everything up. Right? He knew these things very well and could organize them in this or really any other matter. This is the last chapter of the book, as you see with this closing poem. Okay. One other interesting component of this work is the dictionary of this work. Right? I already mentioned this. That this work includes many different things, one of which is a Talmudic dictionary, much like our, you know, Jastrow or Frank or whatever dictionaries people are familiar with that we all know and love, right? Here's just a page from this dictionary novel. This has been published. But here you have the entries on the letter Resh and the letter Shin, right? People hopefully now know that the ligature at the beginning is the Aleph Lamed, so the first box here. So Aleph Lamed, Resh Yud Shin, right? Al Resh, the letter Resh, right? And at the bottom, he lists a few examples, show them in a second, the letter Shin, right? On the bottom, right? So this is just a page from a dictionary that was part of this work. And here you have some examples of words that Samuel defined, right? Ramya or Rimya, perhaps is pronounced here. The middle one, I think, is Rami, Resh Aleph Mem Yud. The third box here is Resha. That people might know that term from the Talmud, or Rigla, right? All these terms, these Aramaic terms that appear in the Talmud, right? That Shmuel ben Chofni thought he needed to define. Why did he think he needed to define them? Obviously, because he didn't think his audience knew what they meant, right? So clearly, this tells us, I mean, these can be tedious, but it's very interesting because what he's doing is that trying to make the Talmud accessible to people who wouldn't have had access to it, right? That's one important thing this tells us. It also tells us that this audience needed a dictionary, not in Hebrew or anything else, but in Arabic, right? So when they were understanding the technical terminology of the Babylonian Talmud, which is in Aramaic, they are thinking in Arabic. That's the kind of audience that he is speaking to, right? So what this work as a whole, right? This dictionary is just one piece of, I think, of a much larger puzzle. That is this introduction to the Talmud that Shmuel ben Chofni wrote. It really shows us how interested he was in reaching beyond the four walls of the academy. Was this for fundraising purposes? Probably. Was it also just because he felt that this is how you should communicate and share the knowledge of the Talmud? Absolutely. Right. So it really tells us that Shmuel ben Chofni is sort of sitting at this moment where he realizes that the Talmud needs to be spread beyond just the yeshivot, and writing an introduction to the Talmud is a major part of that effort, that is to share the Talmud beyond the walls of the academy, right? And this work was fairly popular in the medieval period and apparently served its purpose, right? Much like many of the introductions to the Talmud we have, right? This was not a time period where people wrote art scrolls or full translations of the Talmud, but rather they wrote, introductory works that made things accessible, right? And this, Shmuel ben Chofni's Introduction to the Talmud, is, I think, the first such work to do this, and really was fairly successful, and judging by how popular it was. In fact, if anyone opens the introduction to any standard edition of the Bavli in Brachot, you will see that there's a Mavo HaTalmud L'Shmuel HaNagid. Is that right? I think that's what it's titled. This has, for a long time, was erroneously associated with Shmuel HaNagid, that we know as the poet and halachist from Spain, right? In fact, that is incorrect. It not only is not authored by Shmuel HaNagid, it's only translated by a different figure, by a different Shmuel HaNagid. It's a translation of a summary of this very work, right? So anyone who has ever opened that, you know, few pages in the end of Brachot in a standard Vilna Shas actually has access to this work in translation in summary form. So, you know, sort of indirectly, but Shmuel ben Chofni's Introduction to the Talmud is still printed in one way or another in the standard Vilna Shas. Right? So this is a work that is of enduring significance. And I think, I hope, that now that we've sort of seen a little bit of it, if anyone wants to go back to that Introduction to the Talmud of Shmuel, that's, you know, actually by Shmuel ben Chofni, you can see some of these ideas in translation, and, you know, breaking down some of the major questions that appear in this work. Okay. So one other major theme, and that is the witch of Endor, right? People who know might be familiar with this story, right? Saul HaMelech is interested in sort of accessing the ghost of Shmuel HaNavi, right? And he does so by way of a Baalat Ov, right? This is a witch, as it's generally translated. And it's a very confusing, abnormal story, let's say, in Tanakh. And certainly something that certainly wouldn't have fit very nicely in our sort of rationalist, naturalist perspective of figures like Shmuel ben Chafni and other Gaon. Although we will see that Shmuel ben Chafni, his position was quite controversial about this issue. And this is sort of an interesting window into some of the broader Gaonic battles over this topic. But before we get there, I want to show you one other sort of naturalist question that comes up in the Gaonim, and that is about the talking donkey the talking snake or the talking donkeys of Chumash, right? This is a passage from Abraham and Ezra, right? Which is very accessible, right? Anyone, can read this on Sfaria. I think that's where I got the first draft of this translation and probably tinkered with it a little bit. And does someone want to read Abraham and Ezra's summary of the Gaonic views on this matter for us?
Rabbi Sarja Gaon says, since we know that only humans are intelligent and capable of speaking, we must conclude that neither the serpent nor Balaam's ass spoke. He argues that in reality, an angel spoke for them. However, Rabbi Samuel ben Hofni took issue with him. On the other hand, Rabbi Solomon ibn Gabirol, the great Spanish scholar and poet who wrote metered verse, arose and disagreed with Rabbi Samuel ben Hofni. It appears to me that we are to interpret the account of the serpent literally.
Right. So the question here is, was there really a talking snake? Right. This is a reasonable question to ask. Ibn Ezra tells us, this was a hotly debated issue in the scholarship before him. And as Dr. Lancaster and others could tell us, this is not the only time when Ibn Ezra is sort of a conduit for much longer and hotly debated issues among earlier thinkers. Right here, he's quoting three figures, two of which we can sort of expect to have written about these matters. That is Sa'd Gaon and Shmuel ben Chafni. I would say, I certainly am, I'm surprised that figures like Shlomo ibn Gabirol, who we essentially know as a poet, Ibn Ezra thought was someone who was fitting to weigh in on this debate between Sa'dia and Shmuel ben Chafni as to whether or not these animals really spoke. Right. So according to Sa'dia, this didn't really happen. Right. It wasn't a literal speech. Whereas Shmuel ben Chafni said it was a literal speech, and Ibn Gabirol said it was not. Right, so we have a sort of back and forth here, the details of which need not concern us. But what is interesting for this larger discussion of Shmuel ben Chafni is that here he seems to be taking, at least according to Ibn Ezra, took a more literalist perspective. But in other places, he's much, much more of a naturalist, and that is what the Witch of Endor is why it is significant, right? Because of the very extreme naturalist, rationalist perspective of Shmuel ben Chafni. So here you have a page from Samuel's Treatise on the Abrogation of the Law, right? This was a major topic, that is abrogation of the Torah. Obviously, it's a major topic when you're living in an interreligious world like Baghdad, where there's Christians and Muslims, arguing left and right that God changed God's mind about the authority of revelation, right? This work is, I think, currently being edited and translated into Hebrew by Svi Stampfer. As you can see, the manuscript is, for anyone, is fairly clear. This is just one page of several that have survived in the Cairo Geniza. And in this work, Shmuel ben Chafni, as we'll see in a second, cited and dealt with this question of the Witch of Endor. Now, the question becomes, why would the revivification of a dead prophet come up in a discussion of abrogation? Right? I think that's a reasonable question to ask, something that I certainly ask. And Sclair, in his work on Shmuel ben Chafni, suggested, he turned to a passage from Sa'd Gaon's Emunot V'Dayot, right, his book of beliefs and opinions, where people were sort of debating different arguments for and against the idea of abrogation, right? And so one of the arguments on in favor of the idea that God could abrogate the law was that just as God could give life and death and then revive, so too God could have give the Torah, change the law to, you know, to something else, right? So there was a close connection in the 10th or 11th centuries between the idea of the revivification of the dead and the world of abrogation, right? So that's according to Sclater, I think it sounds good to me, without having the whole text as yet edited, it seems like that's why this question, the Witch of Endor, the Baalat Og, came up in Shmuel ben Chafni's otherwise unrelated, or at least to us, would seem to be unrelated question of abrogation of the Torah. Okay, so here we have, I mean, I'm not going to, because this text is not yet fully edited, I didn't want to go, you know, sort of go through and transcribe it and translate it myself. And so I just gave you, we'll see in the next couple of slides, examples of later Rishonim citing Shmuel ben Chafni's views. So here we have, from the Radak's commentary on Shmuel Aleph, reporting our concern. Someone want to take this passage from the Radak?
Okay. We are aware of a debate among the Gaonim regarding this matter. Some say that Samuel did not speak with Saul, and heaven forfend, Samuel did not come out of his grave. Not at all. The woman did everything with trickery. This is the interpretation of Ben Chafni Hagaon. He said that even though the upshot of sage's words in the Gemara is that this happened literally, that the woman resuscitated Samuel, we do not accept such matters when they go against reason.
Okay, so according to Radak, we're going to go earlier in a second. According to their doc, in his commentary, so apologies for the typos here, the Shmuel ben Chafni thought that this did not actually happen, right? That it was all a trick on the part of this woman. She sort of did her, you know, fake magic and fooled everyone around her. And even though if you open Chazal, it seems like it really did happen. They say that it happened literally. He says, no, we can't accept that because that's what goes against reason, right? Every, you know, person with a brain realizes that, you know, no Baalat Og can revive the dead, and so too we can't accept that this happened literally. And we're going to see this is controversial in a second, right? If you look actually in a earlier Spanish commentary, Yehuda ibn Balaam, a very very interesting and important commentary, we can see things a little bit more detail. Here you have from Levin's Otzer Agonim, which we talked about in our times, actually, this is just a Hebrew translation of Ibn Balaam's original Arabic that was published already in the 19th century by Harkavi. In his commentary on Shmuel Aleph, someone want to, do you want to continue with this next page? Sure.
Know that Rabbi Samuel ben Chafni Agon denied that Samuel was resuscitated. He brought many lengthy proofs for this. He took the verse, quote, and Samuel said, that's what he said, which appears right many times, to be the words of the woman who tricked Shaul and did all of this herself. He mentioned all of this in his treatise on the abrogation of the law. He maintained this against the view of the early ones, who thought that all the words were said by Shmuel HaNavi.
Mm-hmm.
He said, quote, the words of the early ones contradict reason. We need not accept them. He cited evidence to reject the veracity of this matter in his view.
There you go. Okay, so Ibn Balaam is again telling us, showing us a little bit more what's going on here. So a few things that are interesting that are worth citing. The first, or worth explicating, maybe. The first is Ibn Balaam's comment that they were lengthy proofs for this. This is not at all surprising, knowing we know everything about Shmuel ben Chafni. Right, this attempt to say when Shmuel Aleph says the prophet Shmuel said, right, which would imply that he was alive and no longer dead, right? And Shmuel ben Chafni says, no, this was all just a trick, right? And finally, and then we have again here this willingness to contradict the early ones, that is Chazal, the rabbis, and this is because of reason. You know, it doesn't seem reasonable. It goes against what we know about the way of the world for the Baalat Og to have done such a thing. And here, elsewhere in Ibn Balaam's commentary, he tells us very similar, he makes very similar comments and shedding light a little bit on this huge debate, right? So here in Ibn Balaam's commentary, it tells us the following. It says, Rabbeinu Sadia agreed with the early ones, and his Sadia Gaon accepted the views of Chazal, of the rabbis, and took these events literally, right? And their statements, but he rejected the claim that the women knew all this secret knowledge, right? So you see Sadia sort of dancing between the same problems. We can't really accept that this woman was such a, you know, was really a witch, was really successful at what she wanted to do. But we nevertheless have to take the words of the rabbis literally, right? And then we see here, this will sort of round us out, and I hope that this was totally unsurprising statement, from Shmuel ben Chofni's son-in-law, right? He tells us the following. Rabbeinu Haigaon agreed with Rabbeinu Sadia's view, right? That is, he took the arguably, let's say, more small-c conservative position that these things happened literally. We have to understand them in a straightforward, literal manner. He said, that is, Haigaon said, it is clear. Once a straightforward statement is set forth, that means once you have something that is said literally, right, could be taken in a straightforward way, right, established in a specific manner, we must accept it in a literal sense. That is, that it happened in that specific way, even if we could reinterpret, right? So here we have Haigaon siding with Sadia and weighing in on a lot of issues that we've seen already, right? How literally are you supposed to take verses? How do you balance, you know, this question of literal interpretation against other competing ways of knowing? That is reason in this case, right? And what do we do about times that the rabbis say things that don't align with reason? That is, should we accept them literally, or are we able to reinterpret them? And can they even be rejected out of hand if they go against reason? So all of these issues come up in this question about the Balat Ov at Ein Dor. So therefore, what we have here is a great example of so many of Shmuel ben Chofni's major concerns, right? He is very concerned about taking things literally. He's very concerned about how to balance reason. Clearly, I mean, I think it's not at all surprising. Some of these questions, the extreme views perhaps that Shmuel ben Chofni advocated for, are associated with more extreme positions within the Islamic world that Shmuel ben Chofni was aware of and repeated sometimes, right? So there's a lot of things going on in this one story. You really see a largely forgotten figure who typifies a lot of very interesting things going on. He's trying to advocate for the academies. He speaks more broadly. He's looking beyond, I said, this is called looking outward, right? Looking outward both outside of the academies and outside of the Jewish tradition, right? Shmuel ben Chofni Gaon did both of these things. And he was not always accepted when he tried to do that. I think it tells us a lot about the Gaonic period, about Shmuel ben Chofni as someone who really merits further study. And hopefully I've given you some insights and some beginnings to help frame further study into Gaonic literature. So thank you very much. That's sort of my prepared spiel. We can turn some questions from the chat, and then obviously if anyone wants to jump in on the video, we'll do that as well. So very quickly, I see the new messages. We have this question of, I guess, continuing on this problem of Shmuel ben Eli. Yeah, Shmuel ben Eli did a lot in the late 12th century to sort of announce his own standing in the Jewish world, right? And he sort of showed off and had all sorts of public rituals and really tried to become the major figure. And this is part of the reason he probably, and almost definitely, did battle with the Rambam. The Rambam was unimpressed with all of these attempts to sort of declare himself to be the major authority. And the Rambam therefore, you know, fought against it. So Shmuel, but it isn't, we can't really think of this as sort of a continuation of the Gaonic period, rather as a new way to restart Gaonic authority. There's one tshuva from the students of Rabbeinu Tam, actually, who sent Shmuel ben Chofni a question, Shmuel ben Eli, that is in the 12th century. They sent him a question. They said, what version of the Talmud is correct? Right? They had a question about the text. And it seems like they were prompted to do so because Baghdad or Bavel was sort of the authority of the text of the Talmud, because that's where it was written. But I don't think that doesn't tell us at all that this is a reconstituted Gaonic authority in all of its alleged glory. There's one other question here about the Greenbaum's translation of Shmuel Nechavim's book on the Torah. I quoted that in the earlier slides. I don't actually have a physical copy of the book, just a PDF. And yeah, this is an important work. Greenbaum's, you know, did a lot to bring this to bear. As we already mentioned, the Ibn Ezra is famously tells us that the Gaonim went on and on in their commentaries on the Torah and discussing a lot of, let's say, extraneous issues. This certainly is the case when it comes to Shmuel ben Chofni's commentary on Bereishit and on Tvarim and other places that it survived. I'm just going to put my email in the chat again. And with that, I guess we can open to questions from people who are still participating. But maybe they're not. All right. So I think that I take the silence as that everything has been understood and that we are all excited to learn more about the Gaonim. I thank everyone for coming, for participating, and for Torah in Motion for hosting. And I wish everyone a good day. And please be in touch if there's anything, any burning questions about the Gaonim. Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.